All right, let's unpack this. We are taking a deep dive into some recent and frankly pretty astonishing rhetoric from the highest levels of LDS church leadership.
Right.
We're looking at how they're addressing this, well, this intense conflict that's happening right now around faith, doubt, and intellectual inquiry.
Exactly. And our sources for this were talking about major talks from Church President Russell M. Nelson, and more recently, this really scrutinized address by church historian Kyle McKay. They give us a kind of troubling roadmap
A roadmap for what
for
exactly?
how the institution is responding to all these historical and doctrinal issues. You know, in the age of the internet, this isn't just religious guidance. It's a profound case study in organizational psychology when it's under stress.
Right. So our mission here is pretty straightforward. We want to analyze the psychological and the logical tensions that these statements create for members, especially members who are really trying to reconcile their faith with what the evidence says.
And we're going to use some solid analytical frameworks. We'll be talking about blame reversal and the BITE model for emotional and information control.
The idea is to understand the strategy behind the message. We're not here to judge anyone's faith.
It's vital that you, the listener, understand how this language is designed to work. I mean, when an organization is faced with evidence that, you know, anyone can find online evidence that really challenges its core stories, how do its leaders keep people loyal? That's what we're digging into.
Okay, so let's start at the top. President Russell M. Nelson, General Conference 2021. He said a phrase that just, I mean, it went viral immediately and caused a lot of pain for a lot of members.
Oh, yeah.
The quote was, "Lazy learners and lax disciples will always struggle to muster even a particle of faith."
That phrase, it's just a masterpiece of rhetorical deflection. It is the clearest example of what we call blame reversal.
So instead of the problem being the history or the documents,
Exactly. Instead of that, the fault is immediately put onto the individual. If you're doubting, if you're struggling, it's not the facts. It's you. You're lazy, spiritually or intellectually lazy.
and adding lax disciples on top of that, that really sharpens the knife, doesn't it?
It does, because if you're struggling with something like, say, the Book of Abraham, the message isn't to go find answers.
No, it's just to work harder, be more obedient.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It pathologizes your curiosity. It
Yeah.
says your struggle is because you're spiritually lax, and that pushes vulnerable members towards scrupulosity. They start hyper-focusing on tiny rules to fix what is, at its core, a crisis of evidence. It shifts the whole game from intellectual honesty to personal guilt.
And what makes that lazy learner claim so problematic is that the leadership, they likely know it isn't true. They have the internal data.
They absolutely do. The counter evidence is strong and it's well documented inside the church. You have surveys, reports that were given to general authorities like Dieter Rittdorf.
And what do they show?
They show a demographic profile of who leaves. And it's not the lax, it's people who frequently have higher than average education, higher income. They are often in high level positions.
You mean like bishops or Relief Society presidents?
Exactly. The people who were arguably the least lax. And there's that famous reported comment from Marlon Jensen, the former church historian.
Right.
After he saw this data, he said the church was losing its best and its brightest. So this internal knowledge that it's the high-performing, curious members who are leaving it directly contradicts the public lazy learner label.
It suggests they understand the real issue, but they're choosing to use a derogatory label to dismiss critics.
And to scare anyone who's left from
Yeah.
starting to ask their own questions.
So let's shift to what Nelson actually tells members to do about their doubt. He says to choose to believe and stay faithful. And then comes the really critical part, the isolation tactic.
Stop increasing your doubts by rehearsing them with other doubters.
Yes. That part.
That instruction right there, linking choosing to believe with cutting yourself off from other people who are asking questions, it shows a deep lack of confidence in the church's own claims.
Because if the claims were solid, they could stand up to scrutiny.
Of course. And you have other leaders like Dallin H. Oaks who have flat out said research is not the answer. When the solution to an intellectual problem is just obedience and isolation, not evidence, the system is basically admitting the facts can't support the faith.
Now, to be fair, couldn't a leader argue they're just trying to protect members from, I don't know, antagonistic content?
That's always the framing, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But analytically, this is a core technique of control. Let's use an analogy outside of religion.
Okay.
Imagine you buy a car, and then you find out the dealership scammed a dozen other people. The salesman tells you to stay faithful to the car and only read approved reviews from other happy customers.
That's not protection. That's a cover-up.
It's a manipulative attempt to shut down your critical thinking. It's meant to stop you from finding the truth that is making other people take legal action. When you are told to ignore facts, it raises huge red flags about how much confidence the institution has in its own story.
Nelson also brings up historical sacrifice. You know, Joseph and Hiram Smith's martyrdom, the pioneer's suffering, as proof of truth. And that is very powerful emotional appeal.
It is powerful. And we have to acknowledge the sincere sacrifice in those stories. For a lot of members, questioning the pioneers is a huge psychological barrier. But when you apply logic, you see the sunk cost fallacy.
Meaning that because people died for it, it must be true, and leaving would dishonor their sacrifice.
Exactly. But martyrdom only proves sincerity. It doesn't prove truth.
Right.
I mean, the source material brings up Jonestown. Over 900 people made the ultimate sacrifice there, showing incredible faith in Jim Jones. That sacrifice doesn't prove anything Jim Jones claimed was true. It only proves the depth of their conviction.
And then there's that final, almost perfect piece of apologetics, Nelson's story about the rain on his trip. He said the members had faith sufficient to stop the rain and faith to persevere when the rain did not stop.
It's the ultimate heads I win, tails you lose argument. It's apologetics designed so the house can't lose. If the rain stops, it's a miracle. If it doesn't stop, it's a test of faith.
So any random outcome is proof.
Any random outcome is spun as divine proof. Failure is just redefined as an opportunity for more faith. In that system, the institution can never, ever be wrong.
Okay, let's transition from President Nelson to the church historian Kyle McKay. His talk to BYU-Idaho students had a statement that many people saw as, well, a huge concession.
It was huge. And it's important to remember, McKay is a lawyer, not a career academic historian like, say, Leonard Arrington was. This is important because he made a really shocking admission. He said very clearly that there are compelling reasons to doubt the church's claims.
And that word compelling coming from a lawyer, that's what makes it so powerful.
Absolutely. Think about the legal meaning of that word. Compelling means forceful. It means convincing. It demands your attention. So here you have a top leader, the official historian, telling college students that there are legitimate, convincing arguments against the church's own story.
He's acknowledging the facts are out there and they're powerful.
He knows it. And then he immediately follows it up with the instruction to stare down compelling reasons to doubt and choose to believe.
How can a university, even a religious one, tell its students to just ignore convincing evidence?
I mean, it is by definition an argument for willful ignorance.
Yes.
He is literally saying, I acknowledge this evidence is legitimate, but your duty is to ignore it. To just cling to your belief anyway.
In any other academic setting, that would be an automatic fail.
Of course. To do that, to put feeling or authority over factual inquiry, is to deliberately stunt your own intellectual growth. And that message is even more powerful when you deliver it to a student body like BYU-Idaho, where questioning authority can have very real, very serious consequences.
He then tries to defend Joseph Smith. Right. He calls him mistake-prone at times, and then turns it back on the listener.
Yeah, he asks if they could have done a better job. It's a classic logical fallacy, it's an irrelevant comparison, and it's more blame reversal.
It ignores the scale of the claims.
Completely. We're not talking about some average guy's mistakes. We're talking about someone who claimed to talk to God directly, to translate ancient scripture by divine power.
We're not asking if he was perfect. We're looking at things that are testable, that are demonstrably false.
Precisely. We're talking about things like the Book of Abraham translation being, well, verifiably false. We're talking about financial misconduct. We're talking about documented polygamy with teenagers. To judge a man making those kinds of divine claims by the standard of whether a college student could do better, it's totally beside the point. The level of scrutiny has to match the size of the claim.
Okay, let's get into the control tactics here. McKay then says that doubts come from Satan. He calls him the Prince of Darkness, who appears as an angel of light.
This is textbook bite model stuff. This is the emotional control. When you say doubt is from Satan, you weaponize fear. Your doubts are no longer just healthy intellectual signals that something isn't right.
They become a moral failing, an existential threat.
Exactly. They mean you're being deceived by the ultimate evil. And for a young adult who's been conditioned their whole life to trust authority, that is a terrifying thought. It's designed to shut down inquiry before it even starts.
And yet, in the same talk, McKay claims that Mormon doctrine is everlasting and unchanging. Given the church's history, I mean, how does that claim possibly hold up?
It just doesn't. It doesn't hold up to any historical scrutiny. This is where the intellectual dishonesty really becomes apparent. History shows the church makes huge, monumental changes, and they're often driven by outside pressure, public pressure, legal pressure, not just a revelation out of the blue.
Can you give an example of that pressure leading to a change?
Well, look at the 1978 revelation that ended the priesthood and temple ban on black members. It was framed as a revelation, sure, but it came after decades of pressure from the civil rights movement, from academics, from inside the church.
And the threat of losing tax-exempt status.
That was a very real threat. That wasn't some quiet doctrinal shift. It was a direct response to massive societal and legal force. The same goes for removing the old temple penalties, those oaths to disembowel yourself. That was a response to public embarrassment. So the doctrine does change, and it often changes because of popular opinion.
Then McKay delivers what I think is the ultimate anti-intellectual knockout punch. He says, finding answers to these perplexing questions ultimately is not the solution.
And that's where information and thought control come together, the I and T in the BITE model. To say that at a university is to actively discourage research and critical thought.
He's saying that finding out the truth is irrelevant to faith.
That's it, exactly. The institutional leadership is basically saying, the facts don't matter. Your compliance is what matters. They're trying to inoculate people against the facts by devaluing the very act of seeking knowledge.
So if we put this all together, what does it all mean? You have Nelson blaming the doubter, telling them to isolate. Then McKay admits there's compelling evidence, but says to ignore it and fear Satan. There's a very clear, very consistent strategy here.
It is a systemic effort. It uses blame reversal and sophisticated emotional and information control to isolate anyone asking hard questions. The strategy is to shift the threat from the shaky historical claims onto the personal morality of the member.
So the message is, if you find something that doesn't add up, the problem isn't the church's history. The problem is you.
It's your lack of diligence. It's your lack of faith. And this is the strategy they're deploying now because the sheer amount of information available online has made the old, simpler narrative impossible to maintain without these kinds of high control tactics.
So for you, the listener, maybe the takeaway is this. Doubt isn't a vice. It can be a virtue. It's the engine that drives agency and informed consent. It's the tool that allows you to make conscious choices based on facts, not just compliance based on fear.
Absolutely. And so here is the provocative final thought we want to leave you with. Given that the church spent nearly two centuries hiding or downplaying this critical information, and now their own gospel topics essays, their own attempt to be partially honest, are a top reason people say they lose their faith. What does it say about the church's confidence in its own foundation when its highest leaders are openly telling you to believe in spite of the evidence and to actively stop seeking answers?
That is a fascinating question about institutional confidence in the digital age. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.